I want to start, we're in this series that we're unpacking parts of the book of Revelation. It's not an all-encompassing series, but we're kind of doing overviews of different sections and different visions in Revelation these last couple weeks and then the couple weeks ahead. But I'm going to start off with a question for you guys today, and that will be up on the screen there. It's also in your worship guide if you're a note taker or want to follow along. But have you ever looked at something and saw it much differently than someone else? Imagine that, right? Imagine that. But have you ever looked at something and saw it much differently than someone else? I'm sure there's been many cases, but just to kind of stir your brain, your heart for a couple minutes, I want to give you a couple examples of things. So say you're at the beach and you see this monster. What if you are a mediocre swimmer? Right, you have little swimmies on. They still make them, right? Little swimmies that you put over your arms. Like, you're a mediocre swimmer, and you see this. What would you say? No, and we're saying, like, okay, no cussing. Okay, what would you say? Holy cow, right? Oh my. But if you are a surfer, a professional surfer from the Olympics, what would you say? Praise the Lord, cowabunga, dude, right? Well, I don't know, maybe you say that. You'd be like, yes! You like dive out towards it, like, right? Like two different reactions, like, holy cow, and like, oh my gosh, I'm so excited about this, right? What about this? You wake up in the morning and you have a leaky roof. A homeowner would say, bummer, right? There goes my extra income that's going to fix that. But if you are a roofer, you say, yes, right? Another job site. Keep me to work. And then what about this one? You are a baker, and guess what? It's the wedding day, and you drop the thing. A baker would say, oh, right? But if you are the family dog on the scene, what are you saying? Like, yes, right? I'm allowed to eat all this. You know, maybe you've had that happen before. But isn't it interesting that, like, you can look at the same thing and different parties, different people, different creatures can look at it and have different reactions and see different things there. And even beyond that, did you know that animals see the world a lot differently than human beings, than we do? And it's interesting that there's actually a name for this, of seeing something a little bit different due to how you're able to see it. There's the scientists have a name for it and call this your Umwelt. So this is a German word. So we're going to learn a little German today. Is that okay with you? So Umwelt. Can you say Umwelt with me? Umwelt. So the W is like pronounced like a V in German. So it's your Umwelt. So everybody has an Umwelt. And basically, an Umwelt is a German word that refers to any organism's awareness of its environment, determined by the senses an organism possesses. So every organism has a different Umwelt. And the thing is, like, the world is the same, but different things see it in different ways. And there's reasons for that. Because did you know, this is fun facts for the day, birds' eyes actually have four cones, the color-seeking are seeing cells in their eyes. They have four cones as opposed to humans who only have three. So that little picture there, humans see this, birds see that. It's amazing, right? They have a dimension of color that our brains can't even see or can't even comprehend. Some animals actually have eyes, just like butterflies and moths. They have eyes that can see ultraviolet light. So they see a flower very differently than what we see. Bats, if you know bats, they actually see. They have very poor eyesight, but they see through hearing. They send out sound signals that bounce off and create images in their brain of different things. That creatures' experiences of the world are shaped by different ways of perceiving the world. And so on that note, I think the same thing also goes for us spiritually. That you and I have our own Umwelt. We have our own Umwelt that's shaped by our senses and by what we look around, but it's also shaped by lots of other things, our experiences in life, the different things that we've encountered, the different things that we've been educated on, whatever it is. And we're going to look at this today in our study of the book of Revelation. Because in the chapter we're looking at in Revelation, starting in chapter 4, John, who's the writer of the book of Revelation, and he may have been the apostle John, he may be another John, scholars kind of debate on that. But John has this vision that's really a game changer. And it's a vision where John enters into God's throne room. And basically in that throne room, he's given a whole spectrum that of reality that people don't see, that he would never have seen or sensed in any other way. And so when we're accustomed to seeing a certain way, we really need someone to show us what is really real. We need someone to show us a different perspective or a different umwelt, a different shift in how we sense and see the world, and hence our need for Jesus. We need Jesus. We need Jesus to show us beyond the shadows into the reality where God is really at work and what God is really up to, even behind the scenes. See, Jesus comes in this scene, but he comes to us. He comes to say, I want you to see with different eyes here. And I want you to discover that there's more going on than you thought. And not just more going on, but there's also hope. There's hope. So kind of the stirring question I want to present to you today as we unpack this scripture, what are you not seeing that Jesus wants to show you? What are you not seeing? Is it time for you to do this, to upgrade your umwelt? Well, in this series, we've been in this strange, weird, most misunderstood book in the Bible known as Revelation, and it's very hard to understand. If you just pick it up and read it, you're like, I have no idea what's going on, right? It contains very dark and intense imagery. It can seem really scary at times, and different media have kind of capitalized on this over the decades. But I want to just revisit for a couple minutes here, revisit some things that we talked about in week one of this series on Revelation. And the first is that there's a very important assumption in the book, and that is that there is more going on than what we can see. There's more going on than what we can see. And so the word revelation, it's actually called apocalypsis, where we get apocalypse, has nothing to do with the end of the world. Nothing. But it basically means an unveiling or a revealing. And so we're told in chapter 1, 2 weeks ago we unpacked this, but we're told in chapter 1 of what this unveiling is actually about. It's an unveiling of Jesus. It's an unveiling of where Jesus is in the present, as well as where some allusions to where he will be in the future. And so John, the author, he wrote this book, this letter, while he's exiled as a persecuted Christian. This is about 60 or so years after Jesus, sometime in the 90s, not 1990s, but the actual 90s. While he was exiled to this island of Patmos. And it was this great time of Christian persecution. We talked about how this emperor was just really crazy. He was killing Christians left and right. There were just lots of bad things going on. And so he wrote this letter to seven churches in the known world and in the region. And he meant it to be a word of hope, to people who would look around and think that evil was winning. People that would look around and say, people are dying left and right. I thought Jesus is coming back, and he's not. Maybe Jesus wasn't really who he says he is, people that were doubting. And he's writing to these seven churches to give them those words of encouragement. And so the first vision that he had was a vision of Jesus. Remember that vision? You can read in chapter 1. This vision of this kind of like grandiose vision of Jesus who stands right there in the center of all the churches. Even if you can't see him here on earth, he stands in the center of all of it with us. And the second vision that Pastor Kent was with you from York Still Meadow, he was with you last week and shared the second vision of these messages to the seven churches, meant to hold up a mirror to them, to be unveiling things that were going on in them, that this opportunity for them to right themselves before God. But then there's a scene change in Revelation chapter 4. And we're told that John, the writer, he's moved in the spirit. He's moved from the earthly plane to the heavenly realm. And so this third vision, it has a name. It's called the vision of the Lamb on the throne, the Lamb on the throne. And you'll see why in just a couple minutes. So we're going to look at Revelation chapter 4, starting with verses 1 to 2. It's in your notes. We'll have it up on the screen too. So it says this, John is saying this, after this I looked, and there before me was a door standing open in heaven, and the voice I had first heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this. At once I was in the spirit, and there before me was a throne in heaven with someone sitting on it. And so we don't have time to read like five chapters here. We'll probably be here a long, long time. But once again, I encourage you to read them. But kind of a summary of what takes place after is this description of worship like no other. This description of worship with colors and light. And these 24 elders that are sitting there and these crazy creatures singing and giving praise and glory and honor to God. This is kind of an artist's depiction of what that was like, and this vision of beauty and splendor. But then what follows in the text, it's going to make us question those things. This overwhelming sense of God's presence and all these things going on, what we see next kind of makes us question those things. Imagine that, just like the people who are experiencing persecution for their faith. So there's a scroll that enters into this vision. There's a scroll that's presented, and this scroll represents God's explanation of what's going on in the world. That's what the scroll represents. What is God doing? What is going on in the world? But there's a problem, though. Nobody in that whole area, nobody in the throne room at all can open the scroll. And one of the creatures like cries about this, like, nobody can open the scroll. And John is he's beside himself. He's like, well, what are we going to do, right? Until we see in Revelation chapter 5 and verses 6 to 7, then I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing at the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. The lamb had seven horns and seven eyes, which were the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. He went back and took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. So who is the slaughtered lamb? Jesus, the slaughtered lamb. He is the only one who can enter in and help to see differently. He is the only one that can present God's explanation. And you notice that this is not Jesus the lion here. This is Jesus the lamb. And it's clear, the looking as if he had been slain, a slaughtered lamb. In all weakness, in all not predictability, this is Jesus, the lamb, and yet he is the most powerful thing in this entire throne room. Imagine that. What looks weak is actually the strongest thing that could ever be available. What looks terrible and looks slaughtered and like the end and looks like death is actually the most alive and gives life to all that are gathered around. And it's described that he has seven horns and seven eyes. Like, that's a weird looking lamb, isn't it? Kind of not what you would see going out to the farm, right? You're not going to go to the apple picking this fall and see, that's a cute little lamb with like seven horns and seven eyes, right? But this is representative here, guys. But there's a lot of symbolism. Seven is the number of God's perfection. Seven represents God's perfection. So what this is saying is that this lamb has perfect horns, power, seven horns, perfect power, and eyes, which represent what? Sight. Sight, perfect power and perfect sight. That's what Jesus has. See, when we can't see in front of us, he can. When we don't know what to do and we feel powerless, like he is the one that we seek that has those things. But then the vision that follows is what happens when the scrolls are opened. So let's read what happens. So this goes on in Revelation chapter 6. John says, I watched as the lamb. Isn't this like suspenseful, right? It's like, what's going to happen next? I watched as the lamb opened the first of the seven seals. Then I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder, come. I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest. When the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, come. And another horse came out, a fiery red one. Well, what's with that, right? Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make people kill each other. Ugh. To him was given a large sword. When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, come. I looked, and there before me was a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in one hand. Then I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures saying, 2 pounds of wheat for a day's wages and 6 pounds of barley for a day's wages, and do not damage the oil and the wine. That's weird, right? We're going to come back to that. When the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, come. I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death, and Hades was following close behind him. They were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. So if you've read this before, done a Bible study, maybe watched a movie about it, this passage has a title, and that's The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And it's captured the image, the imagination of lots of artists. This is one artist's imagination of what that looks like. This idea of these four horsemen that bring destruction on the earth. And many people in church, pastors included, see this as kind of the beginning of a description of what people call the Great Tribulation. Maybe you've heard that before. If you didn't, don't worry about it. But it's this time of suffering, and you see people that have timelines that say this is going to happen this time, and over the course of years, you know, that people have predicted exactly what year these things are taking place. And when you hear the word rapture, that's most associated with this kind of like unpacking here, where this idea where God turns the earth over to dark forces. But before that, Christians are snatched up into the sky to escape all of it. Well, I hate to burst your bubble, but none of that is really referred to in Scripture, all those things together. That basically people have piecemealed passages from the Gospels, from other parts of Revelation, and they kind of compiled them into that idea that Jesus will save us all from suffering in the last days. See, historically, this idea of rapture and even this idea of great tribulation is a relatively new idea, the last couple hundred years to be exact. Most Christians in history did not believe in that. That I bring it up, though, because I can totally see why people would want to think that way, though. Because wouldn't it be so great? Like, think about this. Wouldn't it be so great if we didn't have to go through suffering and evil in this world if we trust in Jesus? Wouldn't that be amazing? Like, sign me up, right? That'd be amazing. But the thing is, that's not true. That's not true of the world we live in, but it also was not true of the world John lived in. Think about this. This is less than a century after Jesus' resurrection. And what was going on? The world's going to hell in a handbasket. Like, imagine that. Like, I thought Christians are going to be like, you know, saved to heaven and just get excused from all that stuff going on. But instead of escaping, the point of this vision in the throne room is to gain a totally new perspective. One of hope, of a spiritual dimension through which we need to see things. A spiritual umwelt that despite what you may see going on the earth is not the end. That there's dark imagery here that conveys a much deeper meaning. And so that's why we have to ask then, what is the view from the throne room? What is our spiritual umwelt to be seeking here? And I think there's three things that pop out in this scripture. And the first is that suffering is universal. Suffering is universal. And that's why it's problematic if we only see Revelation as being something that's going to happen in the future or something that took place in the past in the first century. That it's meant to show us that something, what has been, is and will continue to be true, and that is suffering is here to stay. Suffering is here now in this world. Suffering is here, and that's where the four horsemen come in. That this is what the four horsemen mean. The white horse, they're all sources of suffering. The white horse represents earthly kings. Earthly kings. And so if you read that, the white horse is an earthly king representing that earthly rulers will promise us so much, but we'll all wind up falling short. Source of suffering, expectation, wrongdoing from earthly rulers. Second is the red horse, another source of suffering, agents of violence. You look around, you see war, you see people killing each other in the streets. You turn on the news, you got to turn it off, right? Agents of violence, that's what the red horse represents, another source of suffering. The black horse, that was the interesting one, where he's talking about day's wages and then like put the oil on the side, and that's economic. It's just interesting that John points that out, right? Economic injustice and havoc that causes people suffering, that causes humanity suffering. And then the fourth horse, the pale horse, representative of death. There's one thing that you and I will encounter someday at some time. It's death. And there's a lot of fear associated with death. There's a lot of pain and suffering associated with death, not just for those that lose their lives, but for those that are left behind. Suffering caused by death. And all four of these things are universal human experiences over all of history. And John is seeing this, that every stage in history usually tends to think that things are worse now than they ever were before. And so it's an important perspective to have, that suffering and pain is around us. It's real. It will be real. It will continue to be real. And it's easy for you and I to think we're the only ones. We're the only ones that have ever experienced this. We're the only ones that are going through this. But I think what John is hearing here, though, is that now is not the time to throw a pity party, though, that we're not the only ones. You and I are not the only ones to experience this. Instead, a perspective is to look around as people who still yet have hope, who still yet persevere, who still yet look around to help our neighbor in the midst of this. But it does not deny that suffering is real. And you and I, even if we follow Jesus, we will suffer. We will suffer. But that's not the end, friends. Because I think there's a second piece here that we see from that view of the throne room. Is first, those horsemen, they're real. Suffering is universal. But the second piece is that suffering is finite. Suffering is finite. And this is such an important part of the scenes that follow, that suffering is only a part of it. It's not the end of the story. See, we read later in the part of the vision, it even gets darker here, if you didn't think it got dark enough. But I want to read this for a reason. This comes from Revelation chapter 8, starting in verse 6. It says this, then the seven angels who had the seven trumpets. Let's just pause there. What does seven represent? God's perfection, God's perfection. Okay, so read that. This is a little interpretation here. Seven trumpets prepared to sound them. So this is part of God's presence. The first angel sounded his trumpet, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and it was hurled down on the earth. A third of the earth was burned up. A third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. The second angel sounded his trumpet, and something like a huge mountain, all ablaze, was thrown into the sea. A third of the sea turned into blood. A third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. So just stop there. So besides being really, really dark and kind of like things of your nightmares, right? Do you notice something? Do you notice the numbers? The numbers? What's the number that's repeated a couple times here? A third, right? So this is like math class, right? A third. So a third is burned up. A third is ablaze. A third turns into blood. Numbers are super symbolic. See, what is the book trying to tell us? Well, it's telling us that suffering is real. Evil is real, but only defines a part. See, we tend to over-focus on the one-third, but what about the two-thirds? There's two-thirds left. See, Jesus here is saying, and the people of the time would have heard these words, not focusing on the one-third, but focusing on the two-thirds. Jesus is saying that the destruction is finite. Suffering is finite. It does not define everything in this world. Evil is finite. It does not define everything in this world. And it's so easy for us as human beings to assume everything is bad, all people are bad, everybody's out to get us. You can't trust anything. I can't do anything. I'm just going to die, and no matter what I do, it's just awful. But that's a lie, friends. Because he's saying here, there's two-thirds left, guys. Like, there's a third. That's less than two-thirds, right? I don't know how to do the math here, but it's true. Suffering is a finite thing. And he's saying it's not the end. But then the third point, though, I think is kind of brings this to a T. Is that suffering is on a leash. Suffering is on a leash. You know what a leash is? Anybody who has pets, right? You have a doggy, isn't he cute? Put him on a leash. I put my cat on a leash. There's Oliver. He walks on a leash sometimes when he feels like it, because that's what cats do, right? But have you ever seen a leash like that? Yeah, like on the boardwalk or whatever, and you're like, just like walking around. You have to look four times, right? But what does a leash do for an animal? Controls them. Controls them. See, God does not cause suffering. God allows suffering to happen. God does not cause suffering. The trumpet was a sound of recognizing that suffering was coming. God does not cause it, but he does allow it. But you have to remember where we started here, is that there is a throne and there is a Jesus who is still on it. There is a throne and Jesus is the one on it. And if you pay attention throughout the book, next week we're going to get into like the Satan piece and the devil thing. So you're going to, if you're really interested in that, like definitely join us next week. But we have to pay close attention, and you see throughout all of Revelation that whenever there's a depiction of the devil, of Satan, he's always on Jesus's leash. Always. Allowed, but controlled. See, God is in the process of stopping bad things and eradicating evil, but he's not doing so immediately. He didn't do so immediately. And the why of it is a huge question, friends. It's a great question why people even question Christianity overall. But I think overall this reminds us that evil and suffering, though, can be used to bring about something good. It can bring about something good. And you know this, right? That sometimes when you suffer, it's a warning, maybe some choices that you've made. It can be a warning that if you keep going down that road, then things are going to get worse for you. Sometimes when we confront evil, that's often when it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse because it's a sign that God is winning. You ever do that? Like you choose like the right path. You're like, hey, I'm going to set this up. I'm going to do the right thing. And you start going. And then things what? They get super hard. Well, I wonder why, right? Like, it's a sign that God is beginning to win, so those evil is going to try to win you. And so right in the middle of all of this, the suffering is universal, suffering is finite. It reminds us suffering is on a leash because there's another vision that John has, and that's in Revelation chapter 7. Right in the middle, before that whole vision of the seven angels and the third burned up and all that, he sees this. He says, after this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands. Who are they? Who are these people? They're defined later as these people who have come out of great hardship and suffering. These are the people who have obeyed the Lamb, who have chosen to follow the Lamb. These are the people who are Christ followers, who have even given up things in their lives because they have followed Christ. And you know what they're doing when John sees them? They're worshiping. They're worshiping. Despite what took place, despite what they endured, despite what they have seen, they are worshiping. And so friends, if we want to upgrade our umwelt, if we desire to have that spiritual perspective from the throne room rather than here on earth and be confused about what's it doing, you know what is key in that process? Worship. Worship. Worship together anyway. Like when you're not feeling it, when the worst things have taken place, when it seems like evil is winning and you need to worship. That's the most important thing. And so that's how we change from the inside out. Upgrading, if you want that spiritual perspective, like maybe you're going through something right now or facing something, or you're just constantly discouraged when you turn on the news or social media or whatever, the first thing to do is to continue to worship. And friends, that's why this is so important. This is not the only way we worship when we gather here on Sunday morning, but it's an important piece because doesn't it change your perspective on the week? You know, like, I mean, I know different weeks when, you know, I look so forward to being here with you all, and it changes your perspective on things. But the second piece, though, is also important. We just sang about this, is asking God to open the eyes of your heart. That when you're facing something that's confusing or upsetting in front of you, to ask God to open the eyes of your heart, that maybe God is the only one that can change that. You know, you're not feeling it, you're not seeing it, you're just discouraged. Like, God, I want that perspective from your throne room. I want to see as you do, Lord. Like, change me. Start with me. Instead of changing them, change me. Change me from the inside out. But I think the third thing here, I think, is also important, is that upgrading our umwelt to have that throne room view, it's also important to spend time in creation. And many of you guys have done this summer, but there's something, and I think that's connected to these creatures, right? And these scenes of the natural world, that God reveals himself not as the only exclusive way, but he does so through the beauty of creation, the creatures and trees, a perspective of a magnificent creator. I don't know about you, when I go off on a hike in the woods, like, it changes me. I call it like a soul cleanse in a way. Like, and maybe you're not a hiker, but maybe just sitting outside and listening to the birds and seeing how God provides for them, it changes your perspective. But then I think the last piece is being thankful, acting in thanksgiving, being thankful. Even if the only thing you could be thankful for is to say, I woke up today, I have a house, a roof over my head, I have food on the table. If that's the only thing you could be thankful for, I have breath in my lungs, I am thankful, and it changes you. See, all of these things changes us, but it takes us to the throne room. It helps us to see just a little bit differently. And so, friends, maybe for you, I don't know what your answer to that question is. What does Jesus have to show you? What are you not seeing that Jesus wants to point out to you? But maybe for you, maybe for me, it's time to upgrade our umwelt. Maybe it's time to see through spiritual eyes. What are you not seeing that Jesus, just like John, wants to show you? Because when it comes to suffering, the truth is we are not exempt, but we are promised a victory over it. You don't have to wonder how it all ends. The power is that we already know the outcome. Because, friends, the Lamb may be slain, but he's also the one that's still on the throne. Let's pray.